On the surface, it might seem that what we would call the problem of death and rebirth has always been something that has been straightforward in its resolution in Buddhism, because Buddhism does, as a religion, have doctrines of rebirth. People die and they're reborn in one of the six realms. This is very well established in Buddhist thought. But that's on the superficial level. Actually, the reality has been a bit more complicated in Buddhism, because it's not been straightforwardly apparent how this would work and what this actually means. Now, one of the things we know about Buddhist philosophy, or even the Buddha's teaching, is that there are different levels of teaching and different levels of interpretation. Later Buddhist scholars worked this sort of thing out very well, in great detail. So, on the one hand, the basic problem could be formulated as follows. The Buddha taught that cause and effect, or dependent origination, is the way in which everything is to be understood, that the law of dependent origination applies to everything. So far, so good. Now then, the question is, if you perform actions in this life which are negative, what are those consequences? Those consequences might be consequences which bear fruit in this life, or they might not. They might bear fruit in a future life. And there are many stories about this, even in the oldest sutras, or suttas to use the Pali, because the Buddha talks about his previous lives, when he performed various kinds of actions of a good character, which led to the accumulation of merit, which assisted in his becoming a Buddha. So the Buddha taught about these things. But the problem is, how did these consequences bear fruit in a future life? So Buddhist thinkers had some difficulty working this out, and they came to various conclusions. Those different conclusions essentially sorted themselves out as different schools of Buddhist thought. And the scholars recognized that these different schools of Buddhist thought effectively were different ways of talking about solutions to the problem for minds of differing levels of sophistication. So the middle way view of the Madhyamika Prasangikas, those are the school of thought that Tibetan Buddhists follow, for the most part, they took the view that what happens at the time of death is that, in fact, all the elements of the body fall apart, which is to say the whole skanda system breaks down, but that something very subtle persists into the new life, and that in the new life, the skandas are reconfigured with the creation of a new body through the joining of sperm and embryo. A new being exists. Is it the same as the old being or not? That, of course, is the question. And from one point of view, the answer is, of course, it's not, because it's a different body. But from another point of view, the answer is, it is in respect to the fact that there are habit patterns that existed in the former life, and those habit patterns are the basis for the persistence of the karmic consequences of actions performed in one life manifesting in the next life. In other words, to use more simple English, the habits that you develop in this life are in some way that's difficult to describe impressed on the mind or impressed on the consciousness, that those habits in some way persist into the future and re-impress themselves or reconfigure the new consciousness of a future life. So in this respect, the future life and the current life and the past lives are both the same and different. So that's one way of answering the question of what persists in the future. Another way is to ask the question, what happens to the I, me? We know in Buddhist thought that the sense of I, the sense of self, is merely a label designated on the five skandhas. So if there are no five skandhas after death, there's clearly no I. But if there are a new set of five skandhas with a new body, a new life, then there will be a new I that's reconfigured around those. Because beings, from time immemorial, according to the Buddha, think I. All beings, whether they're human beings, dogs, hungry ghosts, gods, doesn't make any difference. All beings have the subjective sense of I. It arises naturally from embodiment. So, in a certain way, the I does persist from life to life. Not in the sense there's an absolute continuity of a thing which persists, but the tendency to grasp onto an I does, in fact, persist. So that tendency recreates the sense of I, the sense of self. So in that way, one could say that, in one respect, the I persists from one life to another. In another way, the I does not persist from one life to another. It ceases and is recreated. But the pattern of grasping after an I does persist. So at this point, I think you'd be understanding that the main issue is how do the patterns persist over time? Sometimes I think they're like interlocking pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, that the jigsaw puzzle of one life establishes the form for the jigsaw puzzle piece of another life. That's what I meant, a jigsaw puzzle piece of one life establishes the form for the jigsaw puzzle piece of another life. In this way, we could say there's continuity, but in another way, we could say there's not continuity. Now, ultimately, we're going to have to face the fact that our rational minds are not going to be able to resolve this problem. That it's simply beyond the capacity of the rational mind to understand this clearly. So does that mean that we have to accept the teachings on faith if we're Buddhists? And that if we're just critical analysts looking at this from the outside, as say scholars or religious studies, we say, maybe the system doesn't work too well. I think the answer is probably we can go either direction. The Buddhist scholars themselves came to many different conclusions. They could not reject the idea that there's some kind of continuity, but they couldn't fully solve the problem of what that continuity was. When I say they couldn't really fully solve the problem, I don't mean they didn't come up with solutions. In fact, they did. But different Buddhist schools of thought had different solutions, and they disagreed with each other. Now, we may think that that's a problem. The Buddhist scholars didn't consider it too big of a problem, because as I said, they considered some schools of thought more sophisticated than others. And they thought, well, one kind of teaching is for one kind of mind, and another kind of teaching is for another kind of mind. The Prasangika Madhyamikas of the Dalai Lama school, for example, or I should say he belongs to that school, it's really the other way around, said, well, ours is the highest way of thinking about it, and the others are somewhat less sophisticated because the minds of such people are somewhat less ripe. And that really all that happens is there is a relabeling process, if you will, from life to life. But then they also accepted the idea that there was a subtle mind that continued from life to life, because they accepted the view of the Yogacara school when it came to meditation practice. So they actually had feet in two different perspectives. Now this seems really difficult for us to accept, that there are two ways of explaining things, that they seem to contradict each other, and yet you can hold both ways of explaining things in your mind. Well, Buddhists like the Dalai Lama can do that. They can hold two different perspectives in mind and use them to explain phenomena from two different points of view. And they're not made uncomfortable by this. Now that's an interesting challenge in itself for us to grasp, that we tend to want to take one point of view and establish ourselves as this is the point of view. Every other point of view is incorrect. But for the most sophisticated of Buddhist scholars and practitioners, that's much too limiting. The either-or, yes-no, right-wrongness of our rational minds is something that is our limitation, not their limitation. Doesn't mean they weren't rational. They're very rational. As we know, they pushed the logic of Aristotle, which is a two-part is or is not logic, into four quadrants, to the is not, the both, and the neither is nor is not. And that's a hard one in itself for us to grasp. So, where does that leave us? I think that where it leaves us is that the answer to the question of whether or not our lives, if we're looking at this from our own perspective, or life in general, persists into new rebirths, is an answer that doesn't have a single answer, and that the answer is the answer that makes the most sense to us, and that that's okay. Now, I can't actually leave it at that particular point, that the answer that makes the most amount of sense to us is adequate, is the right answer, is good enough. I'm not going to refute myself by saying that that's incorrect, but I'm going to add another level to the interpretation. I'm going to add another viewpoint. And that is, when we ask the question about past, present, and future lives, we're asking a question about time, and we're making certain assumptions about time, which are in fact somewhat untested. Those assumptions about time were not untested by the Buddhist philosophers. If you look into the writings of Nagarjuna, for example, who's a fundamental thinker for all Mahayana Buddhists, you find considerable conversation, discussion, debate, explication about the nature of time. Now, in sum, what Nagarjuna, and therefore what all his philosophical followers for the next 2,000 years, the position that they take is that we have some significant misunderstandings, naive misunderstandings about the nature of time. And therefore, those misunderstandings influence the way in which we think about the question of past, present, and future, and in particular, about future lives, which is what we're talking about here. Because future lives are in the future. So what do we mean by the future? We think we know what we mean about the future. We think the future is something that doesn't exist as yet, but it will exist. In some way, we think that the future depends upon the present, because what we do in the present somehow unfolds itself into the future. If I plant seeds in my garden this spring, I'll have flowers later in the spring, or perhaps I'll have vegetables in the summer. So we understand that the past somehow becomes the future. But the Buddhist philosophers push things a little more deeply than that. And one of the directions they pushed things was to recognize that the entire way in which we even hold the concepts of past, present, and future, and therefore the concept of time, is dependent, which is to say that we define the three moments of time upon each other. We have no other way of doing it. The way we understand the past is it's not the present and it's not the future. The way we understand the future is that it's not present and it's certainly not the past. And in fact, although we think we can experience present just on the raw nature of being here, in fact, in our minds, we understand present from the point of view of it not being the future and not being the past. So these three moments of time mutually define each other. And therefore, our understanding of time is dependent upon that limited way of knowing past, present, and future. So the philosophers argue that, in fact, we don't really know what time is. We haven't investigated it very closely. And because we haven't investigated it very closely, because we haven't investigated time very closely, how are we going to understand what the Buddha was teaching when he talked about future lives, because that means lives in the future? How are we going to understand what he meant about past lives when he talked about his past life performing bodhisattva actions, which generated the merit, which allowed him to become a Buddha in his lifetime? How are we going to understand these things if we don't know what time is? Now, I'm not going to attempt to solve that particular problem. Not here, not now, perhaps not ever, because it's not an easy one to solve. I'm still wrestling with it, and I've been studying Nagarjuna's thought for over 30 years. But it is important to know the limitations of our own mind in dealing with this problem, which takes me back to my earlier solution, which is the answer that makes the most sense to us is the answer that's going to have to satisfy us right now. And at the same time, if we're Buddhist thinkers, then we're going to recognize that that answer is not good enough. And in some way, we need to push the boundaries of that answer, both analytically in our thinking and experientially in our meditation practice. Now, if we're not Buddhist thinkers, if we're just interested in Buddhism as a system of thought and curious about it, we don't have to go down that line. Any of the answers that I presented will work.